Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you are listening to the 5-year anniversary episode of Improv Nerd. And I can't think of having a better guest for this episode than Scott Adsit. Scott Adsit and I first met somewhere in the 1980s at Columbia College here in Chicago. We took 2 improv classes, which probably the best improv teacher that I've ever worked with, Martin DeMott. Since then, Scott then was hired at Second City, where he did many, many reviews, including the very legendary and famous review, Pinata Full of Bees, which just busted the wall open of Second City, just reinvented the whole form. You probably know him best. He played Pete on the sitcom 30 Rock, which was created by Tina Fey for 7 seasons. He also is the voice of Big Hero 6, a Disney animated feature, and he co-directed, co-wrote, and co-produced Moral Oral on Adult Swim. If you ever get a chance to check that show out, I love it. It's sad, and it's dark, and it's my kind of comedy. We talked to him about so much stuff, and certainly we talked about starting out together at Columbia College, and he reminded me of something that Martin called me during a class. I spoke about this on the last episode. I was not the easiest improv student to work with, and so Martin had his hands full, and Scott reminded me about something that Martin said. He also pays me a great compliment, and I think I took it pretty well. He has a wonderful story about meeting his hero, Paul McCartney, when he was working on 30 Rock. He's got a great story he tells about when they were putting up Pinata Full of Bees, and they did this sketch which freaked out half the audience, and half the audience was in on the joke. It's a great story. I'm not going to ruin it. It's just really wonderful. We also, since this is a live show, we get to improvise together, and he is just, he's one of my favorite people of all time to improvise. He is just so patient, and he tells us a little about his process and how he approaches it and why he still loves to do improvisation. And this guy is truly one of the masters. I'm not going to, usually I fill you in about my life here, but I feel like this episode, there's enough Jimmy in this episode to go around. And also it's the day after Thanksgiving, and we had a lot of people over. I say a lot. We had, I think 6 people besides ourselves. So there was 9 people here, but Lauren and I did a lot of the cooking, and I don't feel like working today. I'm tired, and I'm like, I totally forgot that I had to do this intro. So I'm really not that into it today. So, I'm not even going to apologize for it. This episode makes up for all my ambivalence and all my like, I don't want to be recording this, because this is so much fun. Such a fun episode. I loved interviewing Scott. He tells great, great stories. And I just love improvising with him. And it brings me back to when we first started out back in the 80s at Columbia College. Here it is. Enjoy it. The Scott Adsit 5-year Improv Nerd episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Jimmy, I hated that introduction.
Okay, great. What did you hate about it?
I can't gauge how much the audience actually likes me.
Okay, great.
Because you've given them a false energy.
Well, I'm a phony. I'm a fake. So that's perfect. Your mom is here. Is there any tonight?
Mom, did you make it, Mom?
Oh.
Jenny Adsit, are you here?
Oh my God. How do you feel about that?
I feel as bad as they do.
You grew up in Northbrook, and you went to Glenbrook North High School.
Yes.
Okay. And you said you were a bit of a class clown.
I never said that.
I read that in an interview.
Oh, okay. Then I did.
Okay. Do you remember what kind of stuff you did as a class clown growing up?
I would stop the the English class sometimes and make us do a game show instead.
Like
and
what kind of game
the
show?
The teacher would go with it. Make Me Laugh was on TV at the time.
Which was a thing where you would do like bits to make people crack up.
Yeah, the goal was not to laugh at someone being funny. And we would play it for a good, 20 minutes in class.
How did you get interested in comedy?
Watching TV, I think.
What shows?
Dick Van Dyke. I liked watching like reruns that were on every day, like I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched and things like that. But then I found Monty Python and SNL, and that changed everything.
And then we met at Columbia College. We were in an improv class with Martin DeMott.
Yes.
A legendary improv teacher who I believe never got enough credit.
I never saw him improvise, did you?
No, I didn't. But my guess is I don't think he would have been a very good improviser because the times he would use an example during class, I never thought he had much of a stage presence. Did you? He was kind of corny when he would perform, but a brilliant teacher.
Yes. He knew everything.
He knew everything.
But he's like a the old cliche of a driving instructor. The statistics of driving instructors have much more accidents on the road than their students do.
That's good to know.
I made that up.
Right. Okay, great. So we met there, and I remember being obsessed with getting into comedy to be famous. You were always obsessed at getting better. And who ends up being great and famous at the same time? But you. What do you remember from, what do you use, what do you remember from that class? Do you like this? Do you like what I, does that scare you?
It's very aggressive, your hand.
I'm very aggressive.
I know who you're talking to. When you say you don't have to indicate me.
Okay, great. So I won't point anymore. What did you learn from Martin that you still use today?
Everything. It's like, if that's kindergarten, everything I need to know I learned in kindergarten. And, because we took basic skills from Marty. And it's just the things that stay in my head. I don't know how many improvisers are out there, but the things that you are in danger of forgetting the more successful you get, which are the other person is the most important person on stage, and their ideas are much better than yours, and simply not saying no is the most well-known one, but a lot of people don't know exactly what that means.
Can you explain that? For you, what's it mean for you?
I don't have to explain it to me. I already know.
Okay. Could you explain it to me?
Yes.
Okay.
I've been wanting to explain this to you since then. It is understanding what's going on and what is being asked of you. So you can say yes to everything, but sometimes your partner needs a no for what they're feeling to come to fruition. So you have to kind of like be aware of what kind of answer they need, and that no becomes essentially a yes. And then the other thing is, sometimes you feel so connected to your character that you know that you're playing a mother and she would never slap her kid. That's just not who you're playing. That's not who she is. And Marty was really specific, and I always remembered that if your character wants to say no, say yes, but really grudgingly. And so then we get to see the personal drama you're going through having to say yes to something. So if you don't want to hit your kid, then the kid is making you do this. There's a conflict within you. And it's funny to see, maybe not a kid being hit, but if you don't want to get on a boat, watching you get on that boat grudgingly is entertaining.
Right, so you would grab things. Maybe people have to even pull you.
There's a lot of different ways to do it.
Yeah, I'm just giving an example. Thank you, Scott. And then from Columbia, I'm not going to point anymore. Now I'm self-conscious. From Columbia, you get hired at Second City.
Yes.
And you are part of probably one of the best reviews that I ever saw, which was Pinatas Full of Bees. And as you were preparing to put that show up, there is a legendary story. It's almost become an urban legend. And I don't know if you even know what I'm going to talk about. When you got on stage, I think it was you and John Glazer, and announced the president had been shot.
Oh.
Can you tell us that story?
Yes. So we were looking for some reason. The cast was me and Adam McKay and Jenna Jolovitz and Scott Allman and John Glazer and Rachel Dratch. And Ruby Streak on keyboards and Craig Taylor in the booth. And Tom Janis was directing. And we were looking for, we had just done this 35-year retrospective, which was all kind of the best of Second City, and it was all very old-fashioned scenes that were great, but they kind of seemed creaky to us by the time we were finished doing them. So we wanted to start fresh. We tore the set down, and we were trying to figure out new ways to do this, what we considered an art form. So one of the ways one night was to try to get the audience to feel something other than delight, which, you know, we were thinking, you know, theater doesn't just make people feel good. There's other ways to go, and maybe we can make them feel something and then relieve that pressure in some way and let them be delighted by the end. And so we decided we would go out, I would go out, stop whatever scene was going on in the set, and kind of whisper to everybody, and then announce to the audience that President Clinton had been shot. And this is like, I don't know, it's like 11:30 on a Wednesday or something. And so I think Dratch and Glazer and Jenna were on stage, and they were in the middle of a scene which we was not a scene we were interested in doing, but they just decided to improvise something based on a suggestion or something. And I came out and I kind of just kind of whispered to someone here and made it as realistic as possible, and everybody kind of, you know, reacted as you would without telegraphing anything. All very real. And they go off stage, and I approach the lip of the stage, and I say, something's happened, and I kind of gave this very serious announcement that the president had been shot. We don't know any details right now, but we do know that the reports are coming in now, and I got kind of teary and was really feeling it. And I ended it. I said, so, you know, we're going to stop the show, obviously. We're going to bring a monitor out on stage. If you want to watch the live coverage, there's monitors in the bar out front. You're welcome to stay or go home. No more comedy. which is just unctuous. And so then Adam brought out a monitor on a cart with a VCR on it and everything. And we turned it on, and very serious still, and we're just going to watch this now with the audience. And at the time, in whatever this was, 95 or 6, there was no YouTube, and there were constant ads for sports blooper videotapes you can order. So we turned the TV on, and it's sports bloopers. And I go to try to find the right channel, and Adam says, no, wait. And then somebody gets hit in the crotch or something, and he cracks up. And so then I get involved, and then we're both watching this and laughing, and we're just being distracted from the news of the day. And then the rest of the cast kind of comes out confused, and by the end, we're all sitting Indian style looking at this with our backs to the audience, looking at sports bloopers and laughing, and they're just silent.
Silent, and people are actually walking out.
Some people had gotten up and went to go watch the coverage, and other people were confused, or some people probably thought it was part of the show or whatever. But certainly half of them were very angry when Adam turned around after a long silence of just watching us watch something. Adam turned around and said, "People love sports bloopers!" And then we stayed there and watched sports bloopers until the room was empty. And you know, we felt good that we had made people feel something other than delight. But I think we all generally thought it did not succeed. We thought maybe it was too real, or it was not funny enough in the end, or it was just a lie instead of entertainment. So we didn't put it in the show.
I wonder why.
Yeah, it didn't make the show.
What did you learn from taking that kind of risk? Even though in one ways it doesn't get the reaction you want, but what do you learn in terms of taking a risk like that?
Well, just that we can. I felt like it was our responsibility as artists to to do something unexpected and something that would, because literally half the audience was very happy with the joke at the end. The other half wasn't. And I figured we're doing something right, although this was not the right way to do it. We were doing something right if we could elicit two such polar reactions. Then you got something. But we never did anything with it. There was nothing to do with it. At the end, it just felt like we were just fucking with the audience. And that's not our purpose.
And then after that show was done, you go to L.A., as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Dino brings you out there. Dino, help
Say
me.
It.
Stamatopoulos. And you write this. You write this pilot.
We got hired. He got hired by Barry Levinson,
mm-hmm.
who had just done Rain Man a few years before, and had just come out, unfortunately for him. And he hired, Dino hired me and Mike Stoynoff,
who was the Columbia
Chicago,
guy.
Yep. And Stephen Colbert,
mm-hmm.
To write pilot.
Which I think is interesting because this pilot was about backstage at a Saturday Night Live show. Then you go and you read for Aaron Sorkin's backstage at a Saturday Night Live show.
That's right.
And then you get hired for Tina's Tina Fey's show, which was backstage at Saturday Night Live. And I didn't know that you actually had to make a choice between Aaron Sorkin and Tina Fey.
Well, I was at the callback session, yeah. I was invited to go to producers, which is the last step before... It's a penultimate step, but it's when you sign a contract. And so I was either going to do my final network read for Tina, or I was going to stay in L.A. and read for Aaron for this lead role in Studio 60. And Aaron had just come off of The West Wing. I didn't know him, but that's a huge reputation. He's a giant in the industry. And Tina was, you know, the Spitfire from Weekend Update, but no one really knew anything else about her.
But you had worked with her here in Chicago?
Yeah, we were very, very close here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we'd done...
A couple reviews of Second City.
Two or three, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I went with the person I wanted to spend my days with, which is Tina. So I went with the right one.
Yeah, it really worked out well, didn't it? Because Aaron Sorkin's got canceled and 30 Rock was on for 7 seasons?
Mm-hmm.
What was a highlight from 30 Rock for you when you look back?
Ooh. Well, we did a couple live shows from Studio 8H, which is where they do SNL, and to meet Paul McCartney. That was pretty great.
How was that?
It was one of the best experiences of my life.
Can you tell us the interaction?
Oh, I have a long story.
Can you condense it for me?
No.
Okay, all right.
It's Paul McCartney.
Okay.
All right, I'll try to...
Give me like the 90-second version.
So the Beatles are a huge part of my life, and they're a large part of any decision I make in my life. And so to meet Paul was, you know, it's like Zeus coming down, right? So he was a super surprise guest star walk-on for this live broadcast.
Now, did you know going in there? Or
nobody
not?
Knew. Okay. I think Baldwin knew.
Okay.
Because he has ways.
Mm-hmm.
But it was supposed to be kept very secret.
Right.
And it was the day of the broadcast that he walked in for the rehearsal. And Baldwin kind of let me know he was coming. So I had brought my sister and my mom and my girlfriend and some other people to see the broadcast, and I didn't tell them he was going to be there. So he's walking down that long hallway outside the main doors of the studio, and I said, okay, listen. And we're all kind of milling around between stuff and rehearsal, and my family's there. And I say, okay, don't make any noise. Don't do anything. But someone's walking past, and I don't want you to stare. Don't do anything. This is going to embarrass me. Just be cool. They were all very cool. My mom's going, who is it? Who's there? Who's coming? Who is it? Are you here, Mom? Oh! Were you late?
Yes.
When did you come in?
Just before you started the story.
So you only come to the bits about you.
Yeah. The thing I appreciate about your mom, she's very honest, don't you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
So my mother, who's coming? And
And you wanted to be like, yeah, chill, cool. Mom.
And she was. And so Sir Paul goes behind us and walks over here and starts chatting. And she, my mom's still like, who walked in? Who is it? And I said, okay, don't do anything. Do not react. Look over my shoulder at the man right there. And she goes, oh, that's Lorne Michaels. And I said, the man he's talking to. And then she got it. And so then we do the rehearsal, and I actually meet him, and I shook his hand. Hello. He looked into my eyes, and I thought, well, that's it. I can die now. That's the connection I was looking for in this earthly plane, and I'm done. So we then go up and have a meeting in Lauren's office, which is a little bigger than this area we're sitting in here, and about 100 people who are involved in the show pile into there, and they line the walls, and they sit all over the floor and on the chairs and on the arms of chairs, and it's just packed in there, and we discuss what the live broadcast we're about to do. And I get in there a little late because I was dawdling, and there are people sitting everywhere. There's nowhere to sit. And Paul is sitting on a couch on the far side of the room next to McBrayer and Jane Krakowski. And I see a spot on the floor in front of Paul. And I think, if I do this right, I can sit on the floor and maybe my back will touch his knee. So I kind of like, and like stepping between people's Indian-style seats, and I look up, and Paul, this is in the middle, Lauren's talking, I think, and Paul looks up at me and goes, oh.
Like sit next to him on the couch?
He patted the couch next to him.
Oh, my God.
So I sat down next to Paul McCartney.
How are you feeling at that point?
If there was a meeting, I wasn't aware of it. But I relaxed into it. I played it cool, and I got my arm around him like we were at the movie theater. And I just pretended to pay attention to, what's his name? Lorne Michaels. And we did the whole meeting and everything, and then I stood up, and I was like, all right, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to escape. And I won't embarrass myself. I don't want to like look like a fan. I don't want to start talking to him. I will go. We both stand up. He starts talking to me. And then we chat. And then I'm walking through the SNL studios with Paul McCartney having a chat.
Do you remember what you talked about?
No. And we walked down the stairs and then eventually went to our separate dressing rooms. And I said, okay, well, that's it. I can die now. I don't need anything else in my life. And then we did the show. And at the end, we got on stage on home base there, like the end of SNL, and said goodnights. And Tina thanked everybody who was a guest star. And the credits rolled. We all kind of shook hands with each other. And I got to shake hands with Paul McCartney on camera. And I was like, hey, let me die now. And so then the broadcast ends. And we're all kind of stuck up there because we're like on risers or something, and we can't get off until people in front of us do. So I'm next to Paul McCartney. And just kind of looking at each other like, well, we need to get down there. And then Tina turns around and thanks him, and he gives her a little kiss, and she goes, ooh, and she runs off. And then we're just standing there, still can't get down. So I looked over at Paul, and I go, hey. And Sir Paul McCartney leans over and gives me a kiss on the cheek. And
you blush as you tell this story.
Oh my God.
What is that about?
What is it, the blushing involved?
Yeah.
Well, it's one of the most important relationships in my life, and he's never said a word to me. You know?
What was it about the Beatles that?
Well, let me just finish the story.
Okay. There's more.
You'd think I would have died.
Right.
So he kisses me, and I'm like, okay, I will remember this for the rest of my life. And I start forming this story I'm telling you now. It's like, how should I start the story? And he looks at me, and he goes, hey. So I kissed John Lennon's writing partner on the cheek. And then we chatted some more and joked around and had a great time after the show. And that was one of the highlights of being on that show.
You also were at the Oscars. Now, this is a total unfair question. In the movie, won an Oscar.
The movie is Big Hero 6.
Right.
Thank you.
We just had Jane Lynch on the show, and Jane was talking about, I'm just obsessed, because I think anytime you win an award, an Emmy, an Oscar, that your life is complete. How do those compare, the Oscar and Paul McCartney? It's a totally unfair question.
Paul McCartney is the bigger win, I think.
Okay.
I mean, I doubt he would remember it.
Okay.
But no one remembers that Big Hero 6 won the Oscar either.
So. I did. Well, I didn't remember the name of the movie, but I remember it won the Oscar. And I was very happy for you because it was the number one movie for, 5 or 6 weeks? Is that right?
Yeah, it was the number 3 animated movie they've ever made.
And they, spent millions of dollars on advertising, so the character was on bus stops and on buses.
I played the big white robot.
You played the lead. You were the lead.
Yeah. There, Baymax. Yeah, thanks.
All right, so I could spend 3 days talking to you.
Let's go.
Okay, but there's a time limit here. So part of it is we're going to improvise.
Okay.
We're going to, how do you like to do it? Usually just take
I like to do it up on my feet and as silently as possible.
Okay, great. Which is perfect for the podcast. It's perfect for the people listening on this podcast. So you're going to experience about 5 or 6 minutes of dead air, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about what we just did. So we're seated. And we're here at the Athenaeum Theater, which is a big, big venue.
The Athenaeum's great.
Yes.
Of all the Athenaei I've been to,
right,
this one's the best.
Right. So we're going to get, we'll take a suggestion, and then we'll go into a scene.
A sitting down scene.
A sitting down scene. You're all right with that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm a little nervous because we haven't improvised in a long time. And you're somebody I really look up to. And I just want to if we're going to be honest, and I'm still pointing, you were always great in the class, and I was always jealous because you would go up there and you'd make it so easy, and I was always worried about being funny. You always approached it as an actor.
That's true. I will say this about you, though.
Okay.
I remember Marty, the most generous,
loving,
positive. Everything's got to be positive,
right,
man. About halfway through the semester, he described you as a log on stage.
And he was absolutely right.
Yeah, go ahead. Because I know you to have... You're the greatest improvement story I've ever seen.
Can you tell me that? Because... Could you...
Yeah, you were much heavier then. I think that was holding you back a little bit.
Right.
And you were...
I was what? 268 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I would have guessed.
Right.
And, but you were shy and you didn't trust your own decisions and your creativity, I think. And you were up there with an energy of, I'm not supposed to be here. And then you stuck with it. And you just got better and better. And then, it kind of culminated for me. I saw a show you did with Stephanie Weir called Naked. And it was just a two-person, hour-long, was it?
It was an hour-long, one scene.
I'd never seen anything like that, and it was the best improvising I'd ever seen in my life. And it was you.
Well, thank you. And like I told you, it was all her. And we talked about how she is probably one of the best improvisers I've ever played with.
You know? She's a constant inspiration to me.
Yeah.
I try to tell her that every time I see her, but she won't have it.
And I have regret because during that, I was so jealous of her talent. I mean, it's an amazing talent that it got in the way of the show. And I could have enjoyed it and been a better scene partner.
It was, I can't fault the scene I saw.
Okay. All right. So we're going to take a suggestion and then we're going to improvise.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Could we have a suggestion, please? What did you hear? I heard...
I didn't.
Trump supporter at Starbucks.
Well, you're supposed to say the first one you hear, Jimmy.
Okay, so... Okay, so I heard Trump supporter at Starbucks, okay?
Yes.
And so since this show, we break it down. When I hear that, I freeze.
Why?
Because I'm I don't want to do a Trump supporter at Starbucks scene.
Well, also, it's a viral video right now. Okay. Did you know that?
Yes, I did, now that you reminded me.
Yeah.
Big Hero 6 was your movie.
This gentleman would like to see our take on this recorded incident.
Okay.
So does that mean, in my mind, I'm going, okay, so does that mean I play that guy? Or are we in that situation at Starbucks? Or is it like when this guy goes home and has to say what happened? Or is it Trump inviting him in for a meeting because he really likes his style? So all these, just when he said that, all those things went in my head, and I wasn't sure which one I'd go with. I think I was going to let you decide, and I would just say yes.
Okay, because I'm just in such judgment of that idea that I am totally shut down.
So okay, I need help. Okay, so what do you do? So now you're kind of obligated to do the scene. But now that you've told them that you're not going to enjoy it,
right.
Will they enjoy watching you suffer?
Just help me adjust my brain for this.
Well, you just say yes and then hope for the best.
Okay, great. Okay.
I mean, I don't know. You also try to go to your third thought rather than your first.
Okay.
If your first is, I'll play that guy in that situation that's on video.
Okay.
Then what's your next thought? Next thought is, what is he like when he's not there?
Okay.
Third thought is, whatever you initiate right now.
Okay. Marty.
Yeah.
I got you a latte.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, I wanted this cold.
I know.
Could you go get me another one?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I need $4.
Yeah. Here you go.
Thanks, man. Marty.
What? What's wrong with
you? There's shit going on in that Starbucks.
Why are you whispering?
Because I...
Oh.
I don't want people to know. I started it.
Wait, there's stuff going on that you started?
Yes.
And you don't want to go back in?
No.
Well, you want me to go in?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Okay. Wait.
What?
Marty.
What?
I want you to take this. It's my pocket knife.
I don't want to stab anybody.
You don't have to stab anyone, Marty, but if you get it, it'll fight people off.
I'm not going to threaten anybody with a knife. What did you do in there?
Marty! I'm embarrassed to tell you.
I got to hear this.
And there was a Trump supporter in there.
Yeah.
Okay. And I yelled at them.
You yelled at a Trump supporter?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's valid.
And they... and they yelled back at me.
Oh.
Yeah.
And you embarrassed yourself.
Yeah.
Because you feel you were wrong? What?
Well,
you believe in what you said?
Yes.
Okay, then what are you afraid of?
I'm scared of them.
Of them?
Yes, the Trump supporters.
Well, listen, in this neighborhood, you're not going to find many. You can probably take them.
I know, but there's three in there.
And you're afraid of them?
Yes.
It's not my America.
Marty, we're all afraid. That's why I want you to go back there.
You want me to do your battles?
Yeah. You've done it in college for me.
You want someone else to do all the work for you?
Yes. Remember in college?
You sure didn't vote for Trump, did you?
No, I didn't.
You voted for Hillary because you were like a nanny
shape.
I'm not your nanny, Chuck.
Marty, shut up. I don't want them to know that I voted for Hillary. I barely got out alive. Now, you've done my dirty work my whole life. I cheated off every paper and I wouldn't have graduated.
Well, this is where it ends, Chuck. You want to be a man? I'm asking, do you want to be a man?
Yes, I want to be a man,
okay,
Marty.
Then you march back in there and you tell them they're wrong in your mind for voting for Trump. There are a lot of reasons for you to be right about that. Stand up for yourself. What are you afraid of? The fact that they carry guns? So what? Yeah, I like that look. Yeah. Well, yeah.
I just want to write down what you just said. Okay. What am I saying?
Oh, come on, man. You want me to go in?
Marty? No, I'm going in.
Okay.
And I'm going to say that I voted for Hillary. And if you don't like it, Marty's in the car.
I am.
Can I have my knife back? And if I don't come back, Marty? If I don't come back?
I heard you.
I just want to let you know that I appreciate our friendship and everything you've done for
me. Okay, don't start crying. You walk in
there
crying.
I'm not going to cry.
Okay.
Marty. Marty. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have gotten that job.
Hey, it's going to be okay.
If it wasn't for you, Marty, I wouldn't have lost my virginity.
I know, I'm great.
Marty, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have voted for Hillary.
I'm proud to be your friend, Chuck.
I'm scared, Marty.
I know.
But I'm going to go in there.
That's why I'm proud of you.
And I'm going to take those bastards.
Well, don't kill anybody. You're waving that knife at me.
I'm just practicing.
Okay, but you don't...
I'm a man. Do you think they'll back away just like you did and blink?
Well, I think they're human beings, yeah. You got a knife. But that's not where your strength should come from, Chuck.
Where should it come from, Marty? Where should it come from?
Your righteousness.
Yes, my heart. My heart, like the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz.
You're just simply right.
I'm right.
No, you're right.
I know I'm right.
Be willing to die for that.
I am willing to die for that.
Okay, go in there and die.
I'm going in there and die. Scene. Great job. You are the most incredibly patient improviser. You and Dave Pasquazi, amazing. What
is what?
The trick of being so patient.
Trusting your partner. Isn't it? I think.
So you're so invested in me, not just the words, my facial expression, the emotion, that's what you're reacting to.
Well, the whole situation. And if you are taking a pause, I know it's because you're thinking and I'm letting you think. Or, you know, if I think your character needs to come to something on his own, I let him. It just seems... obvious.
Well, but believe me, I will get nervous and I will ramble. And having someone like you who's so calm and is so patient, and I mean, you're taking in every moment.
Yeah, well,
it
I'm not
slows
looking.
Me down.
I'm not looking to create anything.
What are you? What are you looking? When you
I'm
say
just reacting, as you are. That's all it is. It's that thing that Marty would talk about. This kind of like up and under, building this. Thing where everything is just respond to that, now respond to that, now respond to that, now respond to that. And nothing, it's like being created. It's a crucible.
When did you finally get comfortable with that? Because I would imagine when you started out, you were like most of us and it was about being funny and stuff like that. When did you like ease into that?
I think
that?
When I started getting good at two-person scenes. It's a lot easier to do that in a two-person scene because the silence means something then. When you have three or more people, then... generally, there's very few quiet moments, and they're very important to me, quiet moments.
And you are someone who is still very passionate about improvising. What is it that you're still passionate after, I mean, God, it's like 30 years when we started.
All right. I just like it. I just like being with people, and I like having an audience. I like to hear the response, and I feel like it's something I'm good at, so I like to do it because I can feel good at the end of the night about it.
Great.
Even if I don't have a good night, I've done enough of it that a failure doesn't bother me anymore. That's another reason to keep doing it, because the more you do it, the less you
worry. What is the secret to that? Because I still, if I had a bad show, it doesn't matter if I did 1,000 good shows, I'm still devastated after that bad show.
Yeah, but what's different about your life?
It's a good point, Scott.
No, I mean, really. You come off stage with a bad show and a good show. The only person who's upset about it is you, unless you've really let down your partners, which I doubt you would. It's just like, you know, you missed the ball. That's all.
All right, we got only a couple minutes. If we could turn the house lights up really quickly, I want to get a couple questions for Scott. If we could turn the house lights up so I could see because I'm blind. All right, great. If you have a question for Scott, just put your hand up. Yes, right here.
What's your favorite improv game?
Your favorite improv game?
I haven't done games in quite a while. I used to like to do a thing when I was in Turco at Second City called, we called it Phrase Am I, which is Who Am I? It's a game where you get, someone gets secreted out of the room, and you get a phrase, a cliche from the audience, so Stitch in Time saves nine, and then the person comes back in, and the cast tries to get them to say that scenically. And then it kind of devolves into just kind of like verbal charades as well. Yeah, that's fun.
Great. But another question? I saw one right here. Yeah.
Talk to me about your socks.
These are yellow socks.
Yeah.
And I used to work for Adult Swim, and they still send me Christmas gifts. So this is one of several very garish sock pairs I got. And this one, it says Adult Swim on the side.
But you were always stylish. I remember at Columbia, you would come in like slippers sometimes. You remember this? And pajama bottoms or pajama tops. Yeah. We got time for one more question right here.
Hey, Adult Swim, do you miss doing Moral Oral?
Yes, I love Moral Oral. I love anyone who likes Moral Oral. And we wanted to keep going. We got canceled because Mike Lazzo, who's in charge of the network, thought it got too sad. And we thought the joke was that it was puppets having very real drama in their lives. And we had this 5-year plan where it would go from kind of being a naughty, irreverent little show about hypocrisy that would evolve into, over 5 years, step by step, become the most realistic drama on TV. And we got halfway there.
Great. Let's take a real quick one, and then we got to wrap this up. Right here? Okay, great. Excellent.
Yes. My favorite Pete moment?
From 30 Rock.
When Paul McCartney kissed me. Pete. I like being found naked with a bag on my head and not knowing why.
Taken from your real life?
Yes.
Okay, great. We always end the podcast with the same question. What piece of advice would you give someone starting out in improv and comedy today?
Be someone that people want to work with. Don't be the asshole in the room. And what that means is just go with the flow while still letting your voice be heard and respecting everybody else, even though you may not start out that way. Find the respect that they deserve.
Scott Adsit, thank you so much for being our guest on the 5-year anniversary of Improv Nerd. Thank you, guys. And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. It's not another episode. I don't mean to minimize. It is the 5-year episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest, Scott Adsit. We had 40 minutes and we could have gone easily another hour. It was that much fun. It really was fun. It was so much fun to catch up with somebody that has gone on to do such great things and that you started out with. And it was great. I want to thank Jonathan Pitts, the producer of, I believe his title is the executive producer of the Chicago Podcast Festival, and Tyler Green, who is the artistic director of the Chicago Podcast Festival, for inviting us and including us and letting us celebrate our 5-year anniversary. Of course, I want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. You wouldn't be hearing my voice right now if it wasn't for Dan. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. I pause and I and I oh. Dan makes me sound like I should be on the radio. I also want to thank Sam Bowers, who is the director of the live version of Improv Nerd, and he did a great job. He had a big staff to work with, and we had to work in a big venue. The Athenaeum is about 800, 900 seats. So thank you, Sam Bowers. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and intensives, go to my website, jimmycorain.com, and also sign up for my Improv Nerd newsletter. You'll get a blog that I write, and it will help you become a better improviser and a better person. Well, the better person is up to you. As you know, we're on social media, and as everyone's on social media, you have to be on social media. We're on Facebook, Improv Nerd. Like our Facebook page. As you know, it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us at Improv Nerd _nerd
on Twitter. And then, of course, go to this YouTube channel. Dan is really, Dan Schipmacher is really put a lot of time and effort behind these videos. So you'll see clips from the live shows. But you'll also, we've just put some up on Jane Lynch. It wasn't a live show, but it was an interview where we got some great clips on that. So check that out. Feral Audio. I almost forgot. I feel unprofessional. I blanked it out. We are part of a wonderful podcast collective. We're part of a family. It's called feralaudio.com. So check out all the wonderful podcasts on feralaudio.com. And finally, I can't forget to thank you. You are the ones who listen. You're the ones who write me really nice emails. And I really, really appreciate it. If it wasn't for you, my self-esteem would be even lower. So I want to thank you. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.